Good afternoon and welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM with Padre Greedy and with me, Richard Sanderson. Little Atoms is a discussion show dealing with politics, science, rationalism and humanism. Today we're going to be spending an hour in the company of the philosopher and literary critic Jonathan Derbyshire. Jonathan is a contributor to Time Out, the Financial Times, New Humanist magazine, and he's the reviews editor of the Philosopher's magazine. He also runs his own blog, which you can easily find just by putting the name Jonathan Derbyshire, with an E, in Derbyshire, into Google, and you'll find it straight away. It's got a slightly longer address that I can't remember at the moment, but it's certainly easy to find and it's well worth looking at. And I'm going to ask Padre to start the chat with Jonathan.
Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Good afternoon.
As Richard mentioned, and straight into it here, as Richard mentioned, yep. You're a reviews editor of the Philosopher's magazine. There seems to have been a massive increase in, for want of a better phrase, pop philosophy in the past 10 years. Not accusing the Philosopher's magazine of that, of course. But do you think this is a positive thing in bringing philosophy into the public sphere?
I'm not sure pop philosophy is necessarily a positive development, because I associate that with the sort of latter-day pseudo-religion of self-help. But the incursion of, to take up the last formulation of yours, the incursion of philosophy into the public sphere, I think is a welcome development, and we at the Philosophers magazine like to think modestly that we play some role in that incursion. I suppose behind your question is another question about what role exactly philosophy plays in public affairs and public discussion and public conversation. I think philosophers ought to be quite modest about the contribution that they can make, certainly more modest than Plato was. I don't think we're going to be philosopher kings anytime soon. I'm quite fond, when asked what the public contribution philosophy can make is, I'm quite fond of something that Bernard Williams said, which is that philosophy very simply helps human beings to make sense of themselves. So there's an answer to be getting on with.
Well, to an extent, I mean, being on the left, let's quote Marx here, to an extent, how much can it be said, as Marx did, that the philosophers have only interpreted the world and the point is to change it? Can philosophers interpret and can philosophers change?
I've also thought that's a much misunderstood claim, actually.
Oh dear.
Because you can only change the world once you've interpreted or understood it. So lasting political change, for example, happens on the basis of ideas. So certainly ideas don't change the world, human beings change the world, but they change the world on the basis of ideas. And the contribution philosophers make is clarification of certain fundamental values, ideas, concepts, and so on. And Marx couldn't have literally meant that, otherwise, you know, it would have been self-refuting, because presumably he wanted his own writing and his own philosophy or his own theory to have some sort of effect.
Okay, I'm something of an outsider to the world of philosophy. I've avoided it for a long time after reading some very tough French stuff about 20 years ago, which I found completely impenetrable. And it was only sort of more recently when I discovered people like Russell, and obviously contemporaries of yours like A.C. Grayling, who you know, are tackling the big topics and and are certainly much more approachable. And I wonder whether basically you think that may have been a sort of dead end for philosophy in a way, that it seemed to slip into something in the postmodernist area and some of the French stuff that seemed to be almost impenetrable to the lay reader, as it were.
That's certainly true, and there was certainly French philosophy, and there are deep historical reasons why French philosophy and continental philosophy more generally took this turn.
Mm. I'd be interested in that, yeah.
There was preoccupation with the style in which philosophy was done. And so philosophers like Jacques Derrida, for example, mm-hmm. You can understand them as, in some way, literary modernists. They were interested in the way philosophy was done, as in what philosophers actually said. And I can see that can strike the lay reader as a sort of distancing from what the lay person would perhaps assume philosophy's traditional preoccupations to be. That's to say, the big questions. But this idea that philosophy has become somehow arid, obscure, technical, and impenetrable to the educated general reader. And let's take you, Richard, as standing in for the educated general reader for the purposes of this discussion.
Suitably flattered.
That also applies to the philosophy that's been done in Great Britain and America, so-called analytic philosophy, which, mm-hmm. the criticism goes, has become an aridly technical exercise, preoccupied largely with very obscure and technical questions in the philosophy of logic, philosophy
sort of
science,
stuff
and
like,
so on.
You know, the classic table that Russell will talk about for chapter after chapter in his introduction to philosophy.
Questions in epistemology, the nature and status of knowledge and belief and so on, mm-hmm. questions of the philosophy of language in particular. Philosophy did become, in both the Anglo-Saxon world and in Europe, aridly technical, and lost touch with what we might call enduring, perennial human concerns. You mentioned philosophers like Grayling and Russell, and what's interesting about those philosophers when they do public philosophy is that they try and reconnect philosophy with its traditional preoccupations. Remember, for the Greeks, that philosophy was essentially concerned with the question, what kind of life it's best to lead. As I said, philosophy from the beginning, if you take ancient Greece as the beginning of Western philosophy, mm-hmm. I don't know anything about Eastern tradition, so we'll leave those out of account. But if you take ancient Greece as the origin of Western philosophy, then the original questions for philosophy were essentially moral or ethical. That's the questions having to do with the nature of the good life. What people like Grayling do is reconnect philosophy with those its original preoccupations. And what's interesting about those original preoccupations is that they're enduring human preoccupations. We're still concerned with the question, what kind of life it's best to lead.
And were they also sort of connected to the news and current events as well? I mean, obviously, I can imagine there's a lot of philosophical discussion about war, for example, at the moment. So would that have been the same sort of thing then?
Well, there is a long-standing tradition in moral philosophy called just war theory. I mean, its origins happen to be in medieval Catholic theology, in thinkers like Aquinas, mm-hmm. And St. Augustine. But nevertheless, it's a tradition that's become secularized, and lots of the discussion about recent wars, for example, lots of the moral and philosophical discussion of recent military interventions has been informed by this centuries-old tradition of just war theory. And what just war theory does is tries to think through the conditions under which it might be morally justified to go to war. And so prominent members of what's sometimes perhaps inaccurately described as the pro-war left, such as Norman Garras, Michael Walzer, appeal explicitly to this philosophical tradition of just war theory when trying to think through the issues at stake around, for example, the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an excellent example of how philosophy comes right up against contemporary affairs,
the most
important issues. Issues, as I said, issues of enduring human concern.
Well, you talked there about going back into a tradition of, for example, just war. Is there, on the reverse side, a danger with philosophy of taking things as universal, which may not necessarily be? I mean, was Aquinas specifically addressing Middle Age, Europe of the Middle Ages, or was Socrates or Plato, were they specifically talking about the Greek cities at the time? We tend to universalize with philosophy, and is it necessarily a good thing, or is it good philosophy can be universalized, bad philosophy can't?
Universal in the sense of timeless, you mean?
Yeah.
Meaning that what Socrates had to say wasn't just of interest to the people in the Athenian polis. I think absolutely, it's a very interesting question. Philosophy is unusual, I think, and almost unique among intellectual disciplines in being oddly preoccupied with its history. When you do a science degree at university, for example, you don't, as far as I'm aware, have to spend too much time reading Newton or Ptolemy, because those are theories which have been, not Newton so much, but theories which have been superseded or improved upon. When you do a degree in philosophy at university, you spend a lot of time reading Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, Kant, Hume, and so on. So it's an interesting question why that's the case. It suggests that there's something distinctive about philosophical problems. It might be that philosophical problems don't admit of permanent solutions in the way that scientific problems do. Mm-hmm. So there's an essential, in other words, philosophy can never, as it were, shuffle off its history or escape its history. So there's an irreducibly historical dimension to philosophical inquiry, I think. And so there's something to be gotten from looking at what Socrates had to say about what it means to say that what it means to talk about the good, or when Socrates asks what the good is.
Mm-hmm. Is philosophy a science?
That's a good question.
I appreciate it. It's a tough one to chuck at you like that, but it strikes me as often very, very similar.
Why? I'm going to do something that philosophers do and turn the question back and say why would you say they were similar? In what sense similar?
Okay. Well, I'm thinking of the of Russell and his table and his looking at it and trying to work out in what way it exists.
Yeah.
And that extremely analytical technique does make me think of a scientist actually, you know, who's absolutely trying to get to the essence of say chemistry or atoms or something like that. Mm. And I'm just wondering if it works in the same way. Can you, I suppose what I'm trying to ask is can you get to some established truths in philosophy, or is it always reasonably amorphous?
Well, that's a large question. If I can go back to what I was saying about philosophy's relationship to its own history, that suggests that there is a difference between philosophy and science, that philosophy and science have a different relationship mm-hmm. to their own history. That's to say, developments in science seem to entail that one theory is superseded by another, whereas in philosophy we seem to be worrying about the same questions that preoccupied Socrates 2,000 years ago. And it's an interesting question why that's the case. So that suggests to me that there's one difference between philosophy and science. You mentioned Russell. Russell's view about what philosophy was and what it could do, of course, changed over time. And some professional philosophers think that Russell precisely abandoned serious philosophy when he started writing the sorts of books that you read mm-hmm. for the general reader. What Russell, he called them his penny dreadfuls. he churned them out. Russell began his career committed to a highly a mathematical conception of philosophy. Mm-hmm. So this idea that philosophy, by using the tools of modern logic, could put itself in touch with timeless, eternal truths. It's a rather Platonic notion of what philosophy might be. It's characteristic of philosophy in the English-speaking world that a very influential conception of philosophy in the English-speaking world, it would say that philosophy is essentially continuous with the natural sciences, or indeed go further and say that philosophy is a science. That's and that view is known as naturalism. But not all philosophers by any means are naturalists,
I'm sure.
and I'm certainly not. I think one of the things that distinguishes philosophy from science, it's philosophy's preoccupation with our ordinary concepts. Philosophy might be better understood as conceptual clarification. So when Russell is thinking about the table, he's as interested in what it means to say, I know that's a table, rather than, he's more interested in that question than in the question, what's the atomic substructure of this table?
Yes.
So going back to what we were I suppose I was really getting at earlier was that with the question about the time and place of philosophy, yeah. and universality or otherwise, is we talk a lot these days about the Enlightenment, pro-Enlightenment and anti-Enlightenment sort of ideals. And are we entitled to talk that way? I mean, is there? I've been criticised and on articles written beforehand saying that, like, by people saying, no, you can't just invoke the Enlightenment because the Enlightenment was a very specific set of circumstances dealing with a very specific time. Do we have that right to invoke the Enlightenment, pro or anti?
We have the right to.
Are we right to?
Before we get into that, maybe we could just have a very brief précis of what the Enlightenment was.
Well, my answer to Padre's question was, in a sense, going to be, so that's that it's very difficult to answer that question, and we need to be clear about what we are referring to when we talk about the Enlightenment. Now, you both know, and perhaps you even were even involved in this discussion somewhere in the blogosphere recently. Last year, Madeleine Bunting wrote a spectacularly wrong-headed piece for The Guardian, criticising Enlightenment talk, and she was thoroughly and rightly upbraided for it. But I think on one point, and only one point, she was sort of half right, which is this idea that perhaps we ought to be careful when we refer to the Enlightenment. So when we talk about the Enlightenment, are we making a historical claim? Are we referring, as you suggested, to a historical event? Or are we referring, in a looser sense, to a set of values? That's to say, is the Enlightenment shorthand for a set of values? Values that I would probably call, I think, are better described as liberal values. So values of freedom, autonomy, toleration, and so on. Now, some of the people who came to Bunting's defence made what strikes me as a good point. That's to say, there wasn't just one Enlightenment. Remember, there were at least three. There was the French Enlightenment which we identify with the French philosophes like Condorcet or Holbach. There was the German Enlightenment, which we associate with Kant. And then there was even a Scottish Enlightenment, can you believe, which we identify with Hume. And it's not clear that those philosophers ought to be straightforwardly lumped together. So the question we then have to ask is
what do
they have in common? What they have in common, I think, is the idea that enlightenment consists, as Kant put it, in man's liberation from self-incurred immaturity. And that liberation from self-incurred immaturity involves the use of what Kant called public reason. But there are huge and significant differences between those various versions of the Enlightenment. And interesting, I think those differences replay themselves and reproduce themselves today. I mean, for example, if you look at what we might call the radical Enlightenment, which we'd identify with the French philosopher and also with a philosopher like the English philosopher Jeremy Bentham, the founder of utilitarianism, that version of the Enlightenment is radically materialist and utilitarian. And philosophers like Bentham did think that philosophy was essentially a branch of the natural sciences. They subscribed to a view that's sometimes called scientism. That's to say that philosophy is at best the handmaiden of the natural sciences. Whereas Kant, for example, rejected the idea that morality, as the utilitarian thought, was just a matter of the fulfilment of desires and the achievement of happiness. And Kant thought that morality was rooted in reason. So there are... in other words, the short answer is that we should be careful if we're making a historical claim about there being one thing called the Enlightenment, because clearly there wasn't. I think when the Enlightenment values are invoked today, we're referring to a set of values, aren't we? Which I called liberal values. And I think we can invoke those values and without having to commit ourselves to an answer to the historical question.
I've always thought of Enlightenment values as also being something about sort of rationalism as well. Would that be a fair thing to say? I'm taking a fairly wide definition of rationalism.
The Enlightenment takes, I would say, reason to be central, because rationalism has certain specific connotations which might be more associated, say, with the naturalistic scientific side of the Enlightenment rather than with, for example, the Kantians. So it's the use of reason which enables human beings to pull themselves out of self-incurred immaturity. So the use of what Kant called public reason is the key to our reached intellectual maturity. So it's reason looms large in the Enlightenment, of course, and for Kant, so do values like individual freedom and autonomy.
So when we, or perhaps more accurately, some of the guests that we've had on this show in the past have talked about the Enlightenment being under attack, or Enlightenment values under attack. What do you think they mean by that specifically?
Well, I would take them to mean that the values that underpin a conception of a secular society, mm-hmm. Values like freedom, autonomy, religious toleration, and so on, are under attack. That's quite obviously the case, because it does seem that certain forms of religion are beginning to impinge on the public sphere in a way that we haven't seen for.
And is it just for religion that's the culprit here, or is it other fellow travellers in a way?
Well, I would assume that the fellow travellers would include what you described as postmodernism. Versions of cultural or moral relativism, for example, which precisely reject, to go back to something that Padre was saying, precisely reject the idea that there are such things as universal values or timeless ethical and moral values.
Mm. There's a bizarre story I came across yesterday where the Irish teacher Bertie Ahern came out with a statement that secularists have no place in Irish society. Which, for someone as the head, well, not the head of state, but the head of government of a self-proclaimed republic, is a rather bizarre point.
It was somewhat reminiscent of some comments, was it George Bush?
George Bush Sr., yes, I don't consider atheist American citizens. it's bizarre that we come across this, and he was repeating this, for want of a better phrase, meme, which has turned up in this country a lot lately, of the fundamentalist atheist, the fundamentalist secularist, or who kind of pushing their agenda on an unwilling society. Mm. Where has this come from? I'm hard pushed to imagine.
I'm not sure where it's come from. The gesture of the philosopher is always to say, well, let's try and unpack these terms. We've got two terms in play though already, which is secularism and atheism.
Yeah.
Which clearly don't mean don't mean the same thing. Just before I came here today, I came across a statement of the US Supreme Court, which I think is worth reminding ourselves of, which says that a secular state is not the same as an atheistic or entirely religious state. A secular state establishes neither atheism nor religion as its official creed. So the first thing to say in response to Bertie Ahern would be say, well, there's different. Don't use secularism and atheism as synonyms. Mm. They mean different things. And the struggle that strikes me as politically crucial at the moment is the struggle to defend secularism, and that's a struggle which doesn't just involve atheists. It involves certain non-fundamentalist religious believers, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
The idea about the notion of the moral and religious neutrality of the public sphere.
Yeah.
And so on.
Okay. Well, shall we have some music now?
Yes, it would be a very good time to have it. And
Jonathan's brought along a CD.
Jonathan, you have brought something in which I'm intrigued to hear. So please tell us what it is.
Brought in the new recording by Fulbourne Teversham, crazy name, crazy guys. They are one of the drummer Seb Rochford's many vehicles.
Polar Bear,
Acoustic Ladyland. Yep. He's been associated, and I don't know whether this is accurate or not, and I feel slightly uncomfortable with the phrase, but he's been associated with something called punk jazz.
It's not a new phrase, actually. I mean, they were saying that about James Chance and people like that, 25 years ago.
But he's certainly part of a loose collective of London-based musicians who seem to be re-energising jazz and bringing it into contact with other musics. Rochford is a drummer, and the track that I've chosen is from the album Count Herbert II, and it's called The Love That Was Went Away.
that was Fulbourne Tethersham, the musical choice of our guest, Jonathan Derbyshire, and the track was...
I think it's called The Love That Was Went Away.
It's very hard to tell which track starts and which one isn't. I know it's from a marvellous CD that he brought in, and if you missed the explanation of that, of what that was all about beforehand, well, tough. Well, just before we had the musical interlude there, we were talking about the Enlightenment, Jonathan.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in how the Enlightenment relates to atheism and whether... Because quite often, when I feel that the Enlightenment is under attack, it's exactly the sort of thing that Padre was alluding to, that, you know, that atheists are some kind of... are the enemy in some in some respect. And I've always assumed that it was the Enlightenment that kind of gave atheism a kind of respectability, and I'm wondering, A, if I'm correct on this, and that's where... that's what I'm curious about, really.
Yes, I think that's right. We can understand... If, as Kant says, the Enlightenment is our way out of self-incurred immaturity, then one of the sources of that prior immaturity might have been religious belief. And one thing that does unite those... Remember, we were talking before the break about this idea that the Enlightenment is a disparate set of related but distinct historical phenomena. But one thing that does unite all those disparate thinkers is the idea that human values, ethics and morality, are rooted not in something supernatural but in human nature, or in some conception of human needs. Now, the different philosophers have different ways of unpacking that idea of morality being rooted in human nature, but they're all committed in one way or another to that idea. So abandoning theism doesn't mean we abandon ethics. So Dostoevsky was wrong when he said, when God is dead, everything's permitted. That's clearly...
Yeah, although it's an argument false. We still have.
It is an argument we still have, and... That's slightly chastening, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I wish there was some kind of killer punch that we had that we could use in that argument, but it always seems to keep cropping up.
Moving beyond this, there's from atheism to the next step, humanism. There's often a criticism of humanism that says it's just Christianity without God. How much credence would you give that argument?
I'm not sure I've heard that criticism in that form. Does that mean that humanism is Christianity without God in the sense that it retains Christianity's emphasis on the distinctive preciousness of human lives, for example?
I think, yes, there's certainly that element of the kind of, the yes, probably the sacrosanctity of the individual and of human life, but robbing it of any kind of mystical. Yep. I think generally, actually, what it is a dig saying that as... I think it was Chesterton used to always come out with, there's nothing new under the sun. It's the classic kind of Christian line of, or even if one goes back to, looks at Hindu nationalists or other people, they always say, it's all in the original text. You haven't come up with anything new here.
Well, that's an interesting... that's an interesting question. Because it is undeniable that lots of our most basic moral concepts, you think about, you know, concepts like goodness or charity and
not
so on.
Not killing people.
or not killing people, are rooted in Christianity. Mm-hmm. But the story that we can tell about the last 200 or 300 years, and this might be what the Enlightenment is the progressive secularization of those concepts. Just because a concept has theological or religious origins doesn't mean there isn't a perfectly good and adequate secular use of the concept. And I'm particularly interested in certain discussions that have occurred in the blogosphere, say over at the Butterflies and Wheels website, where some people have been wanting to deny that the certain values that circulate now in secular circles have religious origins. I don't see that we can deny that. That just seems historically false. But because the origins of our concepts are religious doesn't mean those concepts now have to have an exclusively religious use. I'm not sure whether that answers the criticism in the form you... posed it.
Well, it does, because for me it's always, I would have answered pretty much the same thing. It's a fairly cheap argument, you know, just because to put it in a very kind of mild way, just because someone else came up with a good idea doesn't mean it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
And that's it seemed that simple to me. I would have in the past maybe tried to go down that line of, and try and find different routes, which I think is something that humanists try to do rather too much. Say, actually, if you go back further to, you know, different cultures and go back to Greece or whatever, then you will find similar things. But I don't really see any point in denying the certain
roots. But what we'd call the genetic question of the origins of the concept is distinct from the attempt to justify or articulate, or conceptually articulate our values. So let's not confuse those two questions. And it's certainly true that Christianity has an account of, say, equality, the fundamental moral equality of human beings. Let's call that's an Enlightenment value, if anything is, isn't it? Now, the first and one of the most comprehensive attempts to articulate the concept of equality you find in philosopher John Locke, in John Locke's Second Treatise on Government. But ultimately, for Locke, the concept of equality is grounded in theology. But that doesn't mean that now we can't make secular sense of the idea that human beings are of equal moral worth. But by the same token, we should recognise, and it has no bearing on contemporary discussions, that Christianity has had an account of moral equality, human beings being equal in the eyes of God, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not to say, as I say, that we can't make secular sense of such concepts today.
Mm. It's something actually that, I mean, going back to Hindu nationalism, fundamentalist Hinduism particularly, it's a critique come across before that the monotheistic religions have a much better concept of the individual and the moral quality of the individual than the polytheistic religions do, because the individual, it's about the individual's relationship with God rather than the individual's relationship in the broader scheme of things.
Well, yeah, and that also raises a very interesting question about the nature of secularization, because if Richard's been asking about the Enlightenment, one of the things we identify with the Enlightenment is secularization, the process of secularization, of what Max Weber calls the disenchantment of nature or the world. Now, Max Weber, for example, made a very interesting claim, which was that the roots of secularization are contained within Judeo-Christian monotheism, particularly Protestant versions, because in Protestantism, for example, you get that emphasis on inwardness and the personal relationship between the believer and God.
Mm.
And so this historical argument is, it's not far from there to, you know, that distinctively modern preoccupation with the individual and autonomy and so on.
Yeah.
So the idea would be that secularization is latent within Western monotheism. I don't know much about Eastern polytheism, but there may be the beginnings of an answer there as to why secularization has occurred at different speeds in different parts of the world. The chastening recognition we have to make today is, of course, that secularization is not finished. It's not a finished project, and that's the struggle that we're engaged in.
Indeed, I can't remember what I read. I read something that rather encouraging recently that seemed to imply that, encouraging to an atheist like myself, that religion, certainly in this country, is well on the way out. And I sort of sucked a thoughtful tooth on that one. I thought, I don't quite see it that way. Because it may be that certainly that the Christian churches' congregations are diminishing a little bit. But I see rise of sort of quasi-religious things and the sort of New Age ideas is seems to be rising more, and there seems to be a lot of that around. And I'm wondering whether, you know, will we ever be rid of it?
That's a very good question. Some Enlightenment thinkers were, this is particularly evident in the 19th century in this country, some thinkers who we could, I think, plausibly describe as Enlightenment thinkers did think that secularization was an irresistible process that sometime soon was going to be completed. For example, I think it was Leslie Stephen argued, for example, that technological advances in industrialized Western societies would lead to the prompt a more or less complete disappearance of organized religion. Now, as you say, as far as the Church of England is concerned, that might well be the case. But it's certainly not the case that where those technological advances have occurred in outside the West, it's those developments haven't been accompanied by secularization in the same way, and that's a problem. That's a problem for that Enlightenment narrative, that Enlightenment story about progressive secularization. So it raises a question about the persistence and tenacity of belief.
It's quite interesting. I was reading a review you did in your capacity as a literary reviewer, and you were reviewing Dawkins' recent book, The God Delusion.
Yeah.
And you were basically remarking on the way that Dawkins seems almost incredibly frustrated that he can't seem to understand why nobody can see the world that he, in the same way as he does, or a lot of people don't see the world in the same way as he does. And it seemed to me that you had a slight problem with his approach on that.
Well, I think Dawkins is committed to a version of that 19th century story, which treats religious beliefs as essentially delusions. So his book was called God Delusion, which will disappear once a certain set of practices like going to church die out. I mean, unfortunately for the 19th century and for Dawkins, those it hasn't died out. So he then needs an account of why human beings seem prone to religious belief, and one of the things he tries to do in the book, not especially successfully to my mind, is give an evolutionary account of human beings' weakness for belief in supernatural entities.
I actually haven't read the book. I mean, but the argument I always seem to counter is the there's the fear of death seems to be a huge one for me. Just the very fact that you're not going to be here anymore, and the criticism that atheists, let's not say secularists, but atheists never come up with an answer to that one, besides saying, oh well, you know, you can remember the nice life lived, but that doesn't deal with people's very real fear. Now the other, that's kind of a two-parted question, I suppose. The other part is that people will criticize atheism and even humanism as not understanding the social function of religion, and maybe we do underestimate the importance of that, and maybe do we need something to replace that? Should we become a fully atheist?
That's right. And in the review, I mean, I should say, I mean, it's obvious from what I'm saying to listeners that, you know, I am an atheist and a secularist, but I'm nevertheless, I have certain deep misgivings about Dawkins' brand of atheism, and certainly about that book, which I thought was flawed in many ways. Mm-hmm. And one of the criticisms I made of Dawkins in that review, Richard, was that I think he precisely doesn't understand what I think I call the phenomenology of religious belief. That's to say, how religious belief fits into human lives. Mm-hmm. He assumes that people hold religious beliefs as essentially theories about the nature of reality, in the same way that Darwinism and modern science is a theory about the nature of reality. I'm not sure that's right.
It's a very scientific way of looking at it, isn't it?
Yes, and I think it misrecognizes and mischaracterizes the epistemology of religious belief. And I think you're right to point out what the social function of belief, and also the way that religion for many people is the source of, for better or worse, their ethical commitments and their sense of themselves as their sense of their lives as things which have value and meaning. And I think Dawkins is too dismissive of that way of looking at religious belief.
So is he an atheist fundamentalist in a way?
I don't like the phrase, and it's not one.
No, it's a ghastly phrase.
It is ghastly.
You can kind of see what they mean.
It tends to be accompanied by the idea that atheism is a faith position, which is just obviously nonsense. My misgivings about Dawkins are not about the theoretical case he makes against what he calls the God hypothesis. That, I mean, his demolition of that hypothesis is obviously unanswerable and right. He's right at the level of theory. So he's right to say that Darwin's theory of evolution and natural selection destroys the argument from design. And there's an interesting historical point to make here, that one of the reasons that Darwin seemed so successfully destructive of religious belief in this country was that in Protestantism in particular, the argument for design, the argument from design had come to take centre stage. And obviously what Darwin shows us is that there can be design without a designer. Where I part company with Dawkins is what he thinks atheism entails, and related to that, what he thinks the limits of scientific inquiry are. And in fact, this sort of takes us back to the question about the relationship between philosophy and science. Dawkins' atheism seems to go hand in hand with, and it seems to me that for him it is entailed by, it entails necessarily, what I would call a sort of scientific reductionist picture of human beings. Mm-hmm. Such that all the truths that we can discover about human beings can be disclosed to us by the physical sciences.
I'm sure
that's a view that is sometimes called naturalism. And it's one that many philosophers who aren't supernaturalists, like me, reject. So I think yes, of course he's right about the theoretical story, but you don't have to buy the reductionist baggage that goes with that destruction of the God hypothesis.
So, where do we find ourselves then if we're completely rejecting the absolute reductionist?
Yeah.
Everything comes down to specific synapses firing specific times.
Exactly. Yeah.
And on the other hand, we have the supernaturalist. How do we find our position between the two? And how do we, how do we justify the middle way on this? It's not quite a middle way. It's not accepting of supernaturalism, but. Well, how do we explain human acceptance?
Well, the claim would be that things like moral values, for example, are not physical entities and aren't plausibly or exhaustively described in the vocabulary of physics. That doesn't mean that they're something supernatural. We would understand them in terms of certain human needs, for example. Mm-hmm.
But how do we separate the idea of human needs from the step back to the Dawkins line of biological impulse?
It's a vast question. there's a worry about the evolutionary story that someone like Dawkins would tell about morality. Mm-hmm. I think it's one thing to say that our morality, like any form of human behaviour, is rooted in our biology. Clearly, in some sense, that's true. The difficulty is in how you unpack that claim. So for some evolutionary theorists, they would want to say that, for example, they would explain, for example, altruism. That's moral behaviour, acting benevolently towards other people. They would want to explain in terms of human beings' desire to protect and promote their genetic posterity. Some evolutionary theorists want to go even further, though, and this is what I find worrying, and say that in fact our human concerns, our altruistic concerns, aren't in fact our concerns at all, and it's just the behaviour of selfish genes. So there are ways of cashing out the idea that morality is rooted in human nature, short of buying into that reductionist picture, which says that our human concerns actually aren't our concerns at all, because all there is the operation of selfish genes.
For some reason, it's making me think that, in a way, it's like, you know, we've discussed on this program before, the Archbishop of Canterbury in this country, who seems an entirely reasonable chap, and I sometimes think it's almost, you feel like saying to him, it's just one step further to our
come to the dark side,
our brand of atheism for him, really. And I think that, in a way, is the way that we should be going in the rationalist humanist movement. Is instead of perhaps being so strident that we're just putting people off, is actually bringing together, pointing out the similarities that our viewpoint does have with.
That's the other worry with Dawkins, isn't it? That,
yeah.
Dawkins seems to think that atheism is necessarily an anti-religious position. But that's, you can be an atheist. That's to say, you can think theism is false. You can think that there is no supernatural entity or supernatural designer of the world. That's what theism is. Okay. Without disdaining religion and all its works. And Mary Midgley in her said something rather nice about the God delusion, which was that Dawkins writes as if there is no difference between Rowan Williams and Osama bin Laden.
And that got the same haircut.
And that and a beard. Beyond that's, but that's where. And I think that Dawkins probably does believe that. But that just seems to me disastrous. Mm-hmm. And it does seem to me in if we are. If our most pressing political task is the protection of secularism and the attempt to understand what it means to live in a secular state, yes, then we can and indeed, as you say, must make common cause with religious beliefs who share those fundamental values. So commitment to fundamental liberal values of individual freedom and autonomy. Those values are not incompatible with some versions of religious belief. Clearly they're incompatible with crazy Christian fundamentalism or rebellative Islamic fundamentalism, for example.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded for some reason of the protests against the incitement to religious racial and religious hatred laws which took place, which were mostly made up of a combination of the actual protests on the evening were mostly made up of members of national secular societies and members of the Forum of Black Evangelical Churches, which the NSS were saying that this was a terrible law because they couldn't go around saying all religious people are mad, and the Evangelical Church people were saying this is bad because we can't go around saying all gay people and Muslims are evil and going to hell.
And atheists.
And so they managed. Those are two extremes that did manage to find common ground, which is it just reminds me of the an article I read by the National Secular Society Secretary Terry Sandersmans, who said the liberal churches are more of a problem. Than your argument that maybe we should go towards the people that we've more in common with, the nice people, is false because all that happens is that they're a Trojan horse for all the insanity that comes behind.
I can't be right. I don't think right.
I find myself disagreeing with that.
There's a very interesting.
I've softened my position quite a lot.
Very interesting recent book written by the American political philosopher Ronald Dworkin called "Is Democracy Possible Here?" Here being the United States, but I think a lot of what he says is germane to this country, particularly because. What's distinctive about the last 5 years is the way religion is encroaching into the public sphere and taking its place in political discussion in a way that perhaps wasn't the case 10 years ago, but of course is the case in America. Now, Dworkin starts from the obvious and true observation that American politics is in a terrible state and that it seems to have devolved into a form of war between two contending blocks, the blue democratic states, the blue secular liberal democratic states and the red religious Republican states. The route to political peace, as it were, Dworkin says, is an attempt to figure out what are the fundamental values that all American citizens, whether they are religious or not, share. And he says these devolved, reduced to two fundamental values, fundamental value of autonomy and an idea of human dignity. And he tries to show that even religious people, as well as secular people, are committed to those fundamental values, and that it's possible for believers and non-believers to meet and agree on those fundamental values. So then politics becomes not a clash between two irreconcilable worldviews, but simply different ways of figuring out how we best realise the fundamental values that we share. And it seems to me that Richard and I do share certain fundamental values, whether Richard Dawkins likes it or not, with Rowan Williams. I don't share any with Osama bin Laden, but I do with Rowan Williams. And it seems to me politically important that we recognise that. And that's where the militancy of Dawkins' atheism, I think, is becomes disastrous.
I have to say, I mean, I just sort of slightly defend Dawkins. I did really enjoy the book, and there was an awful lot of food for thought. But it was then the reactions to it afterwards did worry me slightly in that it was being taken so negatively. And
it seems to be
I just thought, wait till the Christopher Hitchens book comes
It's a baggy monster of the book. I think Hitchens' book is much shorter. But it seems to be the first half of the Dawkins book, where he just runs through the arguments against the God hypothesis, is unanswerable and brilliant. I just wish he hadn't written the second half, where he goes on about how all religions are so awful, and offers a half-baked evolutionary account of why human beings believe in supernatural entities.
Mm. Well, we're getting close to the end of the show. I was wondering if I could very briefly ask you about a quote that appears on your Norm blog profile.
Yeah.
And the quote, and I've no idea where it comes from, so you'll have to tell me, is pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will.
It comes from the Italian Marxist who died in a fascist prison, Antonio Gramsci.
Oh, right.
And it's a plea for political hope, I think, in the face of looming disaster.
Well, it appealed to me simply because, I mean, we were talking... Padre and I were talking to David Aronovich a few weeks ago. We were sort of, the one thing that really came across was that we were all sort of baffled as to why everybody seemed to think we were living in the most hellish of worlds at the moment, when it seems, and I'm sounding like Dawkins now, it seems blatantly obvious to me that we're obviously living in one of the best worlds that's ever existed, and that, you know, so that was what I took kind of from the optimism of the will section.
I mean, that's an interesting point, and we were talking earlier about defending liberal values, and I'd also want to defend the existing political arrangements as probably, you know, the least worst ones we've come up with yet. And I think the political structures of Western liberal democracies seem to me to be worth defending for all their faults. And Pache, Naomi Wolf, we're not living in an incipiently fascist state.
We'll save that one for another one. Jonathan, it's been extremely enjoyable having you in, and I feel a lot wiser for it. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And
thank you, Jonathan.
We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Thank you.